Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am well.
I'm very happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up, in controversies and non-controversies, I wanted to highlight an interview with the head of Neon, indie film studio Neon, Tom Quinn, who was celebrating his studio being named Indie Distributor of the Year by The Hollywood Reporter. There's a lot of interesting stuff in it about the success of Long Legs, which is by far the biggest indie hit of the year. It's grossed more than $100 million worldwide, including a very impressive $74 million domestic, which I'm pretty sure makes it Neon's biggest film in America ever, unseating Parasite, the best picture winning Parasite. And he also talked about them picking up Michael Mann's Ferrari, which is a movie nobody else was really stepping up to distribute. He said that they basically made about as much money as they thought they were going to on this. It did not turn out to be a huge hit, but they did not lose their shirt on it. You know, it was kind of interesting. But the distribution side of things is where this all gets very interesting. And one thing Quinn talked about jumped out at me. So he was talking about Hitman, the Glenn Powell, Richard Linklater movie that was on Netflix, wound up on Netflix. I actually saw it in a theater. It was one of the few, too. It was mostly on Netflix. Here's what he said. Quote, the film was made for, I believe, somewhere between $5 and $7 million. We offered $10 million for U.S. rights only, which would have been a record sale. We believe the film would have grossed in excess of $25 million domestically, with a chance of doing maybe as much as $40 million. Considering what's happened this summer with Long Legs, I think we would have been proved right. And no discredit to Netflix, but they paid in excess of $20 million for that film with a few other multiple territories, end quote. And it's interesting to think about, you know, because we all on this show, I think, liked Hitman, and we thought it would have been decent to see with a crowd. But one thing that if you've been paying attention to the industry at all, over the last few years, you've noticed is that Netflix and the other streamers like Apple TV Plus and some of the others, one thing they have done in recent years is really cut the legs out of the mid-market distributor marketplace, right? They're offering enormous sums of money for movies that are either award season contenders or might have played well with audiences, might not have. They were kind of risky. And I still think Hitman is a slightly riskier movie than Quinn is suggesting, though. You know, who knows? Glenn Powell, big star, could have been a big hit. The straightforward reason for doing this on the part of Netflix and the other streamers is that they think that these movies are movies audiences like, and that they are in the business of giving audiences good stuff to watch, and they have to pay a little extra to overcome the stigma of being on streaming and to make up the back-end profit participation for the filmmakers. The guys who make these movies jump at deals like this because the mid-budget comedy and drama space are kind of a crapshoot financially. Many of them, most of them probably, end up taking some minor loss. So if you give them a chance to not only make their budget back but double it, they're going to jump at it most of the time. That's fair enough. I understand that. A thing I've been thinking for a while now is that Netflix and the other streamers are doing something a little more nefarious than that. Basically, they understand that they can't really compete with the studios on the big budget front, right? They don't have the intellectual property to compete with a Marvel or a Disney or the Minions or Warner Brothers, right? The stuff that Netflix is making is not that kind of audience pleasing movie, and they also can't buy those movies from the studios because they have their own streamers, and also they don't want to, the studios don't want to give up the big pile of cash that they get theatrically from them. But they can cut the legs out of the theatrical business model in general by depriving theaters of mid-budget crowd pleasers, which hurts both the studios, who rely on theaters to be open, and the theaters themselves, which run out of stuff to show when there isn't a new Spider-Man movie or whatever, new Minions movie in theaters. And that's why Netflix paid, say, nearly $500 million for two Knives Out sequels. It's not just that the movies do well on the service, though they do. And I'm sure Netflix has all sorts of numbers suggesting that they are, you know, they retain audiences, they drive signups, blah, blah, blah. The real thing they do by spending $450 or $460 million or whatever it was on two Knives Out films is keeping Knives Out movies out of the theaters. They keep them out of big $200 million, $300 million grossing performances. And they want to do that to, again, undercut the competition. This is basically like Walmart selling stuff below cost to kill the general store on Main Street. Same basic idea. And I, like, again, I wouldn't say necessarily that we should have antitrust investigations into this or anything, but I do think that there is a, you know, there's a slightly more nefarious thing going on here. Peter, am I being unduly conspiratorial? Am I just broadcasting my own issues with the folks in the world of streaming?
So let's say this is happening. I don't think I totally understand why you believe that this is nefarious at all. Netflix is overpaying in at least some of the cases, and probably in most, for a bunch of movies, and then making them available for relatively cheap to a very large audience. That means that that more movies like that can get made. It means that filmmakers, producers, people, financiers of films can make their money back to make more movies. It means that actors can get paid, screenwriters can get paid for these sorts of things. And if you put them in theaters, well, you know, sometimes they make their money back, sometimes they don't. But I think even before Netflix started doing whatever it is you think they're doing, and I'm not even convinced necessarily that that's what's happening, but even before then, it was clearer and clearer that moviegoers were just less and less inclined to see smaller, mid-budget, less visually spectacular films in theaters. Because certainly since the Marvel era began, you basically see the top 10 movies, the top 20 movies every year are just sequels, franchises, big-budget, blockbuster-type things. There's probably three exceptions here that I've forgotten about, but that's basically true, even if it's not 100% true, is that you just don't see giant grosses for films that feel a little more like television in some ways, like Hitman did. And I liked Hitman, and that's not even an insult. But when I say feel like television, I mean they're essentially domestic. They're about people in rooms talking, right? They don't have any kind of effects work or certainly nothing too significant, too spectacular. And what people want from the big screen experience is a big movie experience. And so this doesn't smell all that nefarious to me. In fact, it seems like maybe they are keeping the mid-budget feature alive.
Well, my argument here is that it is essentially an anti-competitive practice in the sense that they are trying to destroy the theatrical business in general by ripping out one of the legs that, you know, kind of keeps one of the smaller legs, but one of the legs nevertheless, that keeps the theatrical experience in business. Because once they destroy the theatrical experience, and Netflix has not been shy about being at best having antipathy toward theaters and really wanting them to go away because they want Netflix to be the number one stop for everybody, for where everybody goes. They want to destroy the theatrical experience because that not only eliminates one source of competition for their eyeballs, that and sleep. You know, they can't get rid of sleep, but they can get rid of theaters. And it will also hurt all of the other studios, which still rely heavily on the theaters that do exist for the big tentpole features that Netflix, frankly, can't make money on, that Netflix has never been good at making money on. They can't put a Red Notice in theaters and have it gross $500 million like Marvel can with an Avengers film. They cannot put a Gray Man in theaters and have it make $400 million like a Minions movie. That's not what they do. They're no good at it. So they want theaters to go away because theaters going away hurts the studios as much as it hurts the theaters. It hurts all of their competitors.
Far be it from me to defend Netflix, which, you know, I am just quite suspicious about in terms of its role in atomizing American cultural life. But I wonder if they are a little less in competition with theaters than with television. I mean,
yeah.
Again, this is not like a huge part of their business yet, but they clearly are investing more sort of in a live events business, and totally breaking the habit of movie going would both cut them off from a periodic, not frequent, but like a periodic source of revenue. They periodically release things in theaters, and it would get people out of the habit of going out and doing cultural experiences together, which they're at least considering as part of their business. Now, they don't want you to do it in a multiplex. They want you to do it in like a wholly Netflix-owned sort of entertainment complex where you can also go to like, you know, a society ball a la Bridgerton, etc. But I would venture, I really, this should be like a footnote to this entire conversation, but I think they are ever so slightly less antagonistic to the theatrical experience than they are to the television networks. And so, you know, I'm not sure Netflix totally knows what its attitude towards live events is, right? And I'm counting going to a movie as sort of a live event, something where you leave your house and like maybe you put on clothes that are not pajamas to venture out into the world and be among fellow humans. But the company appears at least ambivalent to the idea that like on occasion that might be a good thing. So just sheer footnote.
I guess the question is, what would be happening in a world either without Netflix or without Netflix buying up this class of movies?
And can I also add that in part because Ted Sarandos is obsessed with stand-up comics, they do have like a comedy business. And really, you know, a live, like there's the Netflix's Joke Festival, et cetera. Sorry. Anyway.
Yeah. So if Netflix didn't exist, or if Netflix was not buying hitman type movies, would those movies be made? What would people be? Would we be seeing them at all? I think in many cases, at this point, you would see. You probably would see some of these movies just not get made. There would be less money in the ecosystem for making some of these mid-budget, smaller films. That's not every one of them. Knives Out probably still gets made. I don't know about Knives Out 2 and 3, but maybe. And the thing is that in a world without Netflix, YouTube would still exist. And this is the thing that I think everybody in the movie world is only just barely starting to realize, is that the thing that everyone in Hollywood, everyone who pays a lot of money to produce stuff, and I mean that all up and down the budget scale, you know, your $5 million features up to your $200 million movies, your $1.5 million episodes of television, that's real money. Those are expensive professional productions. They're not just competing with other expensive professional productions anymore. They are now competing with YouTube, and YouTube has 10 billion zillion trillion billion hours of footage uploaded every second. It's not possible to watch even a tiny fraction of it. And there's something there for everybody. Apparently, I'm not a big YouTube watcher. You know, I appreciate what my colleagues at Reason do on our YouTube channel. But it just doesn't seem like this is nefarious. If you like movies, if you want to see more of them, if you like middle budget films, it seems like it's probably keeping some of those productions, that type of movie, being made maybe more often than it would if Netflix didn't exist.
Maybe, though. I mean, again, you know, you have Neon out there saying we wanted to buy this. We would have spent more than they paid for it, or we would have spent more than it cost to make, and we would have distributed it, and it would have. But I mean, look, I go back and forth on this because I think you're right. I do think that Netflix is making movies that would not necessarily have gotten a chance to be made. I mean, something like Rebel Ridge, which we may do an episode on. In the coming weeks here, you know, the new Jeremy Saulnier movie was a Netflix production all the way. They paid for that from the get-go, I believe. That was not a pickup. So, you know, that's the sort of movie that, you know, the kind of low to mid budget action revenge thriller, you know, maybe that gets made. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it gets made and it's cheaper. It doesn't, you know, have as good a cast or look quite as good. And I go back and forth on this. I do go back and forth on this because I think you're right. I think the audience benefits, at least in the sense that more people get to see this stuff. And look, here's the other thing, right? Netflix does give these movies a much wider chance of being seen. You look at like A24. Let's talk about A24, the cousin to Neon. A24, a movie like I Saw the TV Glow gets released in, you know, a couple thousand screens by A24, but they don't really have any idea how to sell it to most of the country. They have no idea what to do with this movie, really. And it ends up grossing about $5 million and it disappears. And it's on HBO Max and, you know, there's Blu-ray, whatever. But like, if that is on, that's on Netflix, that probably gets seen by 10 times as many people instead. Maybe that's better for it. Maybe it's not better for it. I don't know. That's a prestige-y type film. It's a prestige-y indie type film. I don't know. That's a movie that benefits from being seen by 40 million people in its first week. So I don't know. I really am torn on this.
The other thing I would add is that for a number of the films that we've talked about here, specifically the Knives Out, the sequel, Glass Onion, and then for Hitman, it was possible to see those movies in a theater. Now, not for everyone all over the country. Yes, the releases were somewhat more limited. Even here in Washington, D.C., Hitman was only playing in one theater. It was over the Alamo Drafthouse over in Virginia, so I wasn't able to make it over. And they don't come with big marketing budgets, so they're not like really trying to move people to get butts in seats in the way that something like Dune 2 is, right? Like, it just has a giant, giant marketing budget that is really about getting people to come out to the but you can see it if you are a theater nut and that's how you want to see
now,
it. A bunch of these movies,
you can't necessarily see it though. They play it in a couple dozen to a couple hundred screens. They don't tell anybody about it. There's no advertising, and they bury these. They do this as a sop to the filmmakers to say, hey, we put your movie in theaters. You know, we did it. We did it, and then people got.
I agree. There's no big marketing budget, and yes, I said it's not going to be available for literally every person in the country in the way that Deadpool and Wolverine is. But for film nuts who live in bigger markets, they can go make an effort to go see these things on a big screen if that's what they want. I saw Army of the Dead and in a theater in Arlington, I think, with Alyssa when yep. that came out. I saw Glass Onion, the Knives Out sequel, in a movie theater. I could have driven over to Virginia to see Hitman if I had wanted to. I just didn't get around to it. It is possible. And so it's not fully eliminating the theatrical experience for people who want to make an effort during the week or two release.
This is ridiculous. This is the ridiculous Netflix theatrical releases do not count as theatrical releases. They are
I'm not saying they are the same.
They're almost counterproductive, frankly, because Netflix can point out and see, like, nobody wants to go see these movies in theaters. Look at how little money they made on a per theater basis. So of course, nobody went to go see the movies that nobody knew about. And my understanding is Glass Onion actually did pretty well. That would have done much better with a bigger theatrical release. But, you know, Netflix doesn't want to put it in theaters in a serious way. They want people to come to Netflix and watch it, which I understand. That's their business model because their business model is killing the theaters. That's what they're trying to do. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that the mid-tier studios are having so much trouble competing with Netflix to get movies into movie theaters? Alyssa.
Capitalism is controversial.
Peter.
It's not a controversy. Capitalism is not a controversy, and neither is this practice.
This is a controversy, and Lena Khan should get on the horn with her lawyers and start to break up Netflix and Amazon Prime Video and Apple TV. Get all that antitrust going. Yeah,
you're gonna love.
Peter is looking at.
You're gonna love
me
the future where there's no more movies being put on your television, but there's also no movie theaters, and the only thing you can watch is YouTube on your phone. And I guess that's your giant collection.
You want. That's the future you want, because that's the most where, oh, that's the lowest cost of blah. It's the future. That's the future libertarians want, is YouTube future. Boo. It's like something out of Stephen King. Nightmare. Awful.
You know, I love watching stuff on my phone. It's just, it's the ideal viewing experience.
All right. I just wanted to take a quick moment to thank everybody who came to the live event in Dallas on Thursday. Stopped by our happy hour at the Tribune Fest in Austin on Friday. It was great talking to all of you. It's always nice to know this corner of Bulwark has some nice loyal fans. We had some good chats and talked movies and politics. And it was a good time. I was glad to see everybody. We're probably not going to have a bonus episode this week just because of scheduling, because of the aforementioned events and some other stuff that's going on in all of our lives. But we got this one for you today, and I hope you enjoy it, and we'll see you at a future event. Always love going to those and seeing everybody. All right, and now on to the main event. Beetlejuice. The juice is loose again, more than 35 years later, for this legacy sequel that takes pretty much everything that worked about the original structurally and says, no, we won't be doing any of that. And what I mean is this. The original film was structurally, as a piece of storytelling, pretty simple. A couple dies, the couple played by Alec Baldwin and Geena Davis, they die. They have to figure out what the deal with the afterlife is, and they learn they'll have to haunt their own home for the next 125 years. And they decide they want to scare away the yuppies who have moved in from New York City and that they cannot stand. To do this, they enlist the help of a bio-exorcist named Beetlejuice, who's played with Manic Malevolence by Michael Keaton. And that's where the film's weirdness all stems from. Basically, you have a very simple story. With a human heart, this couple grows to like the daughter of the family who moves in with them, Lydia Dietz, who's played by Winona Ryder. They like her. They want her to stick around, but they still want to, you know, get rid of the other. They want to be in their nice little house by themselves with Lydia. And then Tim Burton hangs all his like weirdo sculptures and design flourishes and character designs and all that on top of everything. And it's nice. The result is both like pretty straightforward and incredibly unique. It's one of the weirdest blockbusters in Hollywood history, but it was a huge hit. Led to all sorts of, you know, cartoons and merchandising, et cetera, et cetera. So now we get Beetlejuice, 35 years later. And the problem with Beetlejuice is that it does way too much over way too short a period of time. Lydia Dietz, who's played again by Winona Ryder, is now a middle-aged TV psychic. Her daughter, Astrid, played by Jenna Ortega, is a teen girl being tormented by her peers for her weirdo parents. They must return to the small town in Connecticut where the original took place after the passing of Charles Dietz, who was played by Jeffrey Jones in the original. He does not reprise his role in this film, and indeed, one of the funnier gags, though for entirely extra-textual reasons, are the increasing lengths that the film that Burton and the screenwriters go to keep him off the screen. It's pretty funny. We can talk about that in a second. Maybe that should have been the controversy and non-controversy, what to do with Jeffrey Jones, but neither here nor there. Beetlejuice himself is back, of course. He's still pining for Lydia, and he is being chased by the woman to whom he was married during the Black Death. She's played by Monica Bellucci. She's a soul sucker. When literally, she sucks the souls out of the dead ghosts, and they die for real this time, I guess. They're really dead. They're dead, as opposed to just, you know, afterlife dead. She is being chased by a ghost cop, who's played by Willem Dafoe, who was in his before life, he was an actor playing a cop. Now he's a cop. An actual cop. Ghost cop. Total ghost cop. Lydia, meanwhile, is being wooed by a TV producer/conman played by Justin Theroux, whom Astrid hates because he's not as good as her father, who died in the Amazon. Astrid herself, meanwhile, is dating a local boy with a secret in Connecticut. That's just a lot. There's a lot going on there. There's too much going on there. None of these subplots are given anything close to enough time to breathe. They all suffer as a result. The first act of this movie is like 100 minutes long. It's like 100 minutes long, which is a problem because the whole thing is about 107 minutes long. There's too much setup. It's all setup. And then the resolution is all very perfunctory. Now, maybe you don't watch movies like this for the plot. I don't know. Maybe you just want the nostalgia. You want the member berries. You get plenty of those. You get plenty of those in this movie. Remember Remember that guy with the shrunken head at the end of the first movie? You get a whole room of them in this movie. There's a whole room of them. Remember how the Dietzes were possessed and forced to perform Deo with their awful yuppie friends? Got another sequence just like that in this film, and it's even longer. It's longer and bigger. It's better, I guess. I don't know. I don't know, man. The people in my theater seem to mostly like this movie. I think it got a B+ from CinemaScore, which is good, but not great. I thought the whole thing was a lazy, sloppy mess. I thought it was poorly plotted. I thought it was overstuffed and undercooked. It had some nice flourishes. I like Tim Burton's aesthetic. I always have. There were some cool little things here and there. But overall, it was disappointing. And frankly, Michael Keaton tries in this, but he is clearly a little more restrained this time around. And that doesn't work for this character. That's not what this character is. I don't know. Alyssa, what did you make of Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice?
So I feel like I'm a fascinating test case because I've never seen the original and therefore have absolutely no nostalgia whatsoever. And so I am sort of the person who walks into this and I'm like, if a sequel is supposed to be able to stand on its own, I am the person that you want to sit in the test screening and be like, so did any of this make sense or resonate with you at all? And the answer is a resounding no. I thought this was awful. And I think part of what was kind of fascinating about it to me is like, my understanding is this was like a real star-making turn for Winona Ryder. It was a big deal. Lydia just seems so incredibly awful that she's just sort of this. And I don't think that Winona Ryder is necessarily acting poorly in this movie, but the character is so just gutless and personality free that having to spend time with her on the screen is unpleasant. And it also makes no sense why a, pinstriped demon would be chasing her across eternity. Like, why is Lydia Dietz an object of fascination either for Beetlejuice or for American cultural consumers? It is completely unclear from the text of this movie what is compelling about her. And I think it's just a huge problem for the movie that she seems like such a drip. Maybe I'm being unfair. Maybe, not having seen the original, I'm like missing something about her trauma or whatever. But the just sort of charisma void at the center of the movie is a real bummer, especially because I don't think Jenna Ortega is, particularly compelling in this role. And the sort of, the very throwaway sort of political stuff that's scaffolded around her about like, she believes in science, so she's like cares a lot about climate change. It's like the most throwaway lazy joke ever about like, kids today and they're like their concerns about issues, right? The only good joke in the movie is like the house being draped as like a wrapped as a Christo house. Sort of a mourning effort. Like the art world jokes are, to my mind, sort of the only thing that are like fun or comprehensible. And so much of the movie feels like the kind of thing where if, much in the same way that like, if you go into this cold, it's like a very different experience. If any other filmmaker than Tim Burton had made this, people would think they were insane, right? I mean, the sort of self-indulgence of like that idiot Soul Train joke, which is just like both feels dated and it's like not at all funny, right? But they're just like, we're gonna do a bunch of dance sequences in the underworld and like we're really into it, so we're gonna keep it going for way too long. Like,
it goes on forever.
Oh my god,
it goes
on
for, that's not even the possession joke. I was vaguely annoyed with how long it went, although that sequence was done better than this one. But no, the Soul Train joke, it's like a Soul Train joke, it's a night. What year is it? What?
I mean, like, a Soul Train joke would have been antiquated in 1988 when Beetlejuice came out. Like,
yeah.
What? And it's just like, it's not clever at all. And so it's just, the whole movie is just sort of this testament to like floating on just incredibly threadbare at this point pedigree. I thought it was awful. And I just like, I cannot imagine what was charming about the original. So maybe you two can convince me.
I like the original. I like the original a lot because, again, it's very weird. And Winona Ryder is a little bit more charming in that because she's like a put upon teenager. But that sort of role only really works if you're 14 or whatever. You know, that like you can be the goth.
Well, she's annoyed not even sullen or edgy here. She's just a total, like, she's just like a limp dish rag, right? Like,
totally. Total pushover. She has, like, no real...
She seems like a completely wretched mother, right? Like, I can totally understand why Astrid hates her.
Yeah. And the it's so funny that you mentioned the political stuff, because it is, like, it's interesting. If you go back and you read about the making of the original, which I have a little bit, there were notes from the studio that was like, we need to define Lydia. Is she like a punk? Is she goth? Is she, you know, is she sad? Is she like kind of snarky? Like, we really need to drill down into this character. And with Jenna Ortega, her character has like five different things going on with her. She's sad because her dad is dead. She's an angsty, you know, climate change activist. She's annoyed because her friends tease her all the time. Like, you know, like there's an interesting thing to be done with her character wanting to go to the afterlife to find her father, who she did not actually see die, does not know if he's dead. And you could dovetail that with the spoilers. You could dovetail that with the story about her relationship with the ghost boy next door. But like, they do so many things with the character that none of them can stick. It's a real problem. It's a real problem, just of characterization. Peter, what did you make of Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice?
It's very telling that the writers on this movie have worked mostly in television, because this feels like the pilot episode of an 8 or 10 episode season attached to the final 30 minutes of the final episode. And like, you just skipped all the episodes in the middle. There is a pilot's worth of setup, and then none of the development that you would expect to find in episodes 2 through 7. And then you just sort of have a finale that in which a bunch of the elements kind of come together, but not in a way that makes any kind of sense or pays off any of the stuff that you... I mean, it would be hard to pay off much of what is in this movie in a feature length running time, just because it is still doing setup work a full hour and 5 minutes in to its, what, hour and 42 minutes or so of runtime. And so structurally, it is just a total mess. The character work, just from a writing perspective, is similarly a mess, because to the Ortega character, the kid, you nailed it, Sonny. Like, she has all of these things going on, but we don't really ever get a sense of her. That is true for basically every character. We either have too many things going on or not nearly enough, and we never really get a sense of what it is that they want, what it is that their purpose in this movie is, why they are here in this film. And I mean, like, especially for a 100-and-something-minute feature, you really need to tighten up the story and make it about a single clear goal, or at best, several different players circling a single clear goal, perhaps for different reasons, say, which is what you get, you know, in a lot of like Guy Ritchie type films, right? And here, it's just like everyone's kind of ping-ponging around, doing a bunch of different things. I struggle to relate like what the fundamental story of this movie is to anyone. I don't know what it is. It is... There's so many different stories that start up and then it ends, but the stories themselves are never developed fully enough for you to even see like what the characters want, what they are willing to do to get it, and the obstacles that are in the way. What is Willem Dafoe doing in this movie? What is Willem Dafoe doing in this movie? I have no idea what that character is supposed to be in this film for. Frankly, the sucking ghost woman, the soul sucker,
the Monica Bellucci.
Yeah, the Monica Bellucci character. I can only barely explain what she's doing in this movie, and that's that they felt like they needed a new big bad for everybody to come in and defeat at the end, right? Like,
and you need so easily defeated.
She's easily defeated, right? Yeah, there's nothing to it. She barely does anything in the movie. The whole film is like this. It's just a mess. I did not enjoy it. There are some design things that are okay. I didn't hate the Soul Train as much as you guys, because, you know, it's a pun, right? Because they get it.
It's not it's even like a terrible soul pun. It's not even a pun.
That's what I liked about
it's
kind
reference.
of.
It's just a reference.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I liked this maybe too strong.
And then there were, and then there were, I didn't two, mind it were because, two Soul Train sequences. Yes, there was one, and then there was another one later. It was like, oh my god,
it was so this good the first time.
This is not as clever as you people seem to think it is.
If you've got a good pun, you should repeat it as many times as possible. If you've got a bad pun, you should also repeat it as many times as possible. But no, this is not a good movie. It is just a total structural mess. Some of the actors seem to be trying. I think Michael Keaton, Willem Dafoe, certainly like seem to. Justin Theroux is actually tries with a not very well written role, but I'm glad that there's not a ton of CG in this movie. Like, if I want to say something nice about it, I think Burton's CG heavy films have just been ugly, ugly messes. Alice in Wonderland, Dumbo. I mean, those are just deeply unpleasant films to look at. And there were some bits of this movie that I did not find incredibly unpleasant to look at. But as a story, as a feature, as a screenplay, this thing just has incredible screenplay problems that no one seems to have even attempted to fix. It doesn't even look like the movie really understands what its issues are. Burton is just there to sort of vamp and do his stylistic stuff, and everybody else is in it because of the paycheck, I guess. I don't know.
I mean, it's one of these movies where the script, I think, has been floating around for a while, and they keep, and sometimes when that happens, when a movie is in development hell for a long time, one thing that happens is that new writers come in. The development afterlife. New writers come in, and the way that you get credit on a rewrite on a script is you introduce new elements. You introduce new characters. It's not rewriting dialogue. That doesn't get you a credit on a screenplay, and that doesn't get you the money that you need, right? You have to introduce elements. You introduce locations. You introduce new characters. And those things start to pile up. So what ends up happening is you get a bloated, overstuffed mess of a movie because everybody's trying to grab a piece of the credit here. And I don't know for sure that that's what happened here. Maybe it's just a bad screenplay and they're like, oh, well, let's go with it. Let's do this. But it feels like a movie that has been around for a long time and had just kept having pieces added onto it. That's where that ridiculous Willem Dafoe afterlife cop comes from. I feel like 30% of the structural problems go away if you just get rid of his character and just have Monica Bellucci chasing Beetlejuice through the afterlife, and Beetlejuice has to help Lydia's daughter get out of the afterlife, and they make a deal, and she reneges on it at the end, and he winds up with Monica Bellucci again, and they end up happily ever after in the hereafter or something. I don't know, man. I literally anything that gets rid of that extra extraneous subplot. And I was not, I got to be honest, I was not as taken by Justin Theroux as you were. I like Justin Theroux in like The Leftovers. I think he's a good actor, but I don't think his character works here, probably because it's underwritten.
It's a badly written part. I agree with that. I think he takes a badly written part and makes it more tolerable than many other actors would.
I don't know. He brings nothing to the role. And like, there are underwritten parts in the first one, like Otho in the first one is kind of underwritten. He's a stereotype of like, a gay New York City 1980s bohemian yuppie style guy. Right. But he makes it work. But the actor who played it makes it work. I mean, he's like he's iconic in that role. Catherine O'Hara, iconic in that first film. Jeffrey Jones was great in that first film.
Catherine O'Hara is quite funny here. I mean,
Catherine O'Hara is probably the best part of this movie, like even better than Michael Keaton.
The art world satire stuff is the only thing that feels sort of closely observed at all or remotely interesting.
Well, that is a passion of Tim Burton's. He was married to an artist for a number of years. He is someone who clearly, like, he's an art school kid, right? Like, he just, yeah. more than a lot of other directors who are, I mean, you can think of Spielberg as he's obviously sort of the film school brain, but like a lot of it, like a guy like Spielberg is that he's a technician. You can think of somebody like Ridley Scott, who's a great artist and like does all of the right, makes these beautiful frames, but he's not like an art weirdo in the way that Tim Burton is. I mean, if anything, he is He is entertainment's foremost art weirdo, certainly of my life of time, you know, of the last 40 years.
Well, and again, the fact that they miss the chance to do like the sort of obvious joke about like kids and climate change, we're like, why aren't Delia and Astrid estranged because she like did something to a piece of art as like a form of climate activism, right? It's like that joke is just sitting there and it hasn't been picked up and I'm so irritated by it. Anyway, whatever.
I want to see the Sunny Bunch and Alyssa Rosenberg version of this movie.
I'm not a professional screenwriter. I'm just an amateur screenwriter. So I couldn't promise that I could make it better, but I couldn't possibly make it worse than what we have here. This is part of the problem here is just the decline of the power of studio executives. Some studio executive needed to be chomping on a cigar somewhere and saying, no, get rid of this balderdash, back to rewrites. I don't know. That's what we need. More top down efforts.
Yep. I agree. It's the bosses are always right. Capitalism is wonderful. And that's happening, you know, at Netflix, which is making some really good decisions.
Does not have a good track record in this regard either. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Beetlejuice, Alyssa?
Oh, my God. Thumbs down.
Peter.
Thumbs down. One for each Beetlejuice.
Thumbs down. It's bad. Luckily, it made $110 million in its opening weekend. So what do we know? We're just dumb critics who are jealous of all the success of Beetlejuice.
Accurate.
All right. That's it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter, @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed, and Beetlejuice wasn't good. Because there's going to be people who say, no, I liked it. This movie was, you're too harsh on this. You should be easier on the big, massively successful movie. No, I won't. Won't do it.
Shan't.
All right, see you guys next week.